So to the first question, you know, I think there's a technical answer to your point, in which case we're also probably saying I don't necessarily consider freedom the greatest good, but the qualities that have got to be kind of paired with it. But to your point about something like health, from that first principle, as Rawls develops his theory, he has a whole list of what he considers basic or primary goods. And he ends up justifying those basic or primary goods in relation to the idea that they kind of allow you to be a more free and full contributor to society. And why he does that is a pretty interesting question, but I think he finds it easier to justify something like access to health in relation to if you're healthy, you can be a fuller participant and a freer participant in democratic deliberations. Then justifying freedom in relation to sort of making health the basic good, if that makes sense. So he does have a list of basic goods like health and education. I think the scheme, though, is that we would have to justify or argue for any of those on the basis of how they allow people to kind of be free and equal members of society. Because that, he thinks, is really the kind of political project. You know, one thing I want to talk about the next stop is, you know, there are people who think in Rawls's wake who want to extend his theory, let's say, to certain conceptions of environmental justice. And how some of them do that is by saying you need a certain quality of environment to truly kind of be a free and equal participating citizen in democracy. So, I don't think it's not kind of a naked freedom that's the greatest good. It's kind of freedom as an ability to participate in society that then justifies all these other things. I don't know if that helps.
And I had two questions as well.
Oh, I gotta get back to the dishwashers, but I will. but go ahead, throw your questions out because they might be related.
Finish with the dishwasher.
What's that?
You want to finish with
it? Well, I think that's a really good question, right? So, again, Rawls says that the only way we could kind of bring ourselves to justify inequality is if, again, the kind of floor is raised for the least well-off. And in the abstract, yeah, what does that mean? I think there are two things to be said. One is that Rawls thinks it's really important that principle one comes before principle two. So I'm never going to accept in a just society, kind of a trade-off where my freedoms or basic equality is compromised for some raising of my economic floor. So it's not like you don't get to vote now, but I'll give you a dishwasher. So that, I think, I mean, it's a cheeky example, but it's important, right? We're not trading kind of economic gains for basic liberties. But, you know, in a deeper way, I think it points to the fact that Rawls is really giving us a baseline standard to hold ourselves to. And then there's a lot of thought and deliberation that has to go into applying that. Because in the abstract, I might not be able to say, you know, does getting a dishwasher count? But I think Rawls is fairly confident that if we have, let's say, two or three policies before us, and we look at those two or three policies and say, you know, they're all going to end up with some sort of system of inequality, right? They're all going to stratify society in some way. Which one of these ways actually is best off for the worst? And if we're talking about education policy, that might mean one thing. If we're talking about health policy, that might mean another thing. And if we're talking about putting more money in people's disposable income, that might mean another thing. But in any system, what Rawls is really concerned about is a system where we have inequality, and then we let inequality grow so much that at some point we say, oh crap, we should probably help some poor people. How do you set up a system, and it's hard to think through, how do you set up a system that from the very start, any inequalities are justified on the basis that they actually give more opportunities to people who are at the lower rungs? And so, I mean, that's a very indirect response to your question, but I think there is a way in which these principles in the abstract, it's hard to say what counts and what doesn't. But as a way of thinking through, let's say, three or four, however many concrete options before us, he thinks that might be the case, right? And so it really might be raising up basic economic standards And that might be material goods, but that also could be something like educational access or health access or something like that. You had a couple questions, though. I've got many, so this is great.
So when you outlined his first thought experiment,
yeah.
I was wondering why he chose something that would be so hard for humans to do, ignore all of our culturation, mm-hmm. rather than saying we need to make sure that every voice is included.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I could provide a certain voice as a woman,
mm-hmm.
and just make sure we're not leaving voices out.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my one question.
Yep.
The second question was, when he talks about the freedom, is there a responsibility side to that freedom? Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of people in our society now enjoy freedom,
yeah.
but they don't participate, they're not responsible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good questions. These are great. So I will say, you know, this other model that you're proposing, where instead of in some ways trying to limit our access to knowledge when we sort of think about these principles of justice, instead having one where we actually have a surplus of knowledge, right? And I know everybody's position, and maybe I'm called to empathize with people or understand them in a certain way. I think it is one response you see to Rawls, right? From some other thinkers who say, like, actually, this is what we need to do, right? Have everybody at the table sharing as much about themselves as possible. I think Rawls's concern is, while that might get us a reasonably just outcome, right? We might agree to principles that are reasonably just. There's no guarantee that with that kind of setup, we're going to get principles that are truly kind of treating everybody as fair and equal. I think the concern is that you're always a little bit going to argue on behalf of your own people, right? And you're going to say, I'm going to set up a fair system, but really I'm going to kind of make sure that I'm protected, right? That somehow my wealth class or race or gender or religious class. And so he thinks, again, that if justice is really supposed to be, I mean, in some sense, we all have, right? We have statues of, like, Lady Justice being blind, right? If justice is really supposed to be impartial in this kind of way, what we need to do is kind of not think about who we are. In some ways, try to make ourselves ignorant of that. And I think he sees that as a way of trying to take seriously the idea that I could have been somebody else in society, right? I could have ended up in another position. And would I be okay with these principles if I were there? But I think it's a good question, and I think it's an open... I mean, you mentioned that it's hard for human beings, and I do think there's some really good questions to ask about whether or not another model would be easier for us to kind of fall into. But I don't know if that helps. I think that's kind of where he wants it. He's afraid that we'll get to maybe, you know, a kind of status quo that works, right? But it won't ever be kind of completely free and really completely equal unless we kind of try to argue in a way that we're not thinking about our own advantages and maybe taking very seriously that we could be somebody else. Now, your freedom question is a good one, but I'll get other questions in.
I get that model up, absolutely, you know. Hypothetically, mm-hmm. it's important to, even though we know we can't really do it,
right.
we still theoretically mm-hmm. try to stop back and try to create a blank slate,
mm-hmm.
kind of,
mm-hmm.
and then go from there. And that, I think that makes perfect sense to, as from the reasoning standpoint. One thing I wanted to ask, though, about was when you were saying about the theory of, like, equality
mm-hmm.
and how as long as... those that the inequality, those with much more,
mm-hmm.
are creating a system that produces something more
mm-hmm.
for the bottom,
right.
then that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I have trouble with that
mm-hmm.
because everything's relative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to say, oh, you're better off than if you lived in Syria,
mm-hmm.
you know, sure, that's an excuse more than mm-hmm. anything. So, I mean, if you really want to talk equality, you got to look at the circumstances that we live in and we grow up in and look at other people. It's all relative.
It is. And I think, you know, Rawls' defense, and again, I'll try to give the best version of his theory, and I don't have any interest today in saying he's got everything right. But I think, you know, somebody could say to me, you're better off than you were in Syria, but I think under Rawls' principles, you could also say something like, well, okay, that might be true, right? So there might be some sense in which our inequality does raise my level up more than somewhere else. But it's also true that we've had rising inequality in this country for years and years and years without any kind of real gains in wealth for certain classes, right? If anything, their actual purchasing power, their actual educational levels have, right? And so I think that's where somebody like Rawls would say, that's a time where we have to look at the system. We've allowed for lots of inequality, but there's no evidence that shows that it's actually helping the people who are worst off in society. What is a revision to that look like? And yes, that's always going to be relative to the resources you have in the country, to the absolute wealth level. It's not a scheme that can work without that kind of particular data coming in of like where is actual inequality and what's it actually doing? Because I think that's absolutely right. But I think that's what he wants to give us tools and I think language for diagnosing that. But yeah, I think the question is a really good one. To the freedom and responsibility one. Yeah. I certainly think Rawls does think there are responsibilities going on with that. I mean, part of that is his saying that you have as much freedom as long as it's compatible with freedoms for other people, right? I was talking with somebody with Lori on the way about, right, there's all kinds of ways in which, oh, I don't know, mask debates, right, bring this up, right? Like, and really the issue, I think, for somebody like Rawls is how do you allow your freedom. You have to check that when it doesn't allow for the same freedoms for everybody else. And we'd have to have really fervent debates in our society about at what level does my freedom start to trample on the freedoms of others. But he does see that as the limit. And I do think it's something that he writes more about in his later works. This idea that in some ways this system does presume that people want to be involved in democratic society. Yeah, so that I mean, you're not going to have a theory of justice that doesn't work for people who are educated to want to participate in democratic society. So I do think there is a part of it where, yes, there needs to be a responsibility, but that requires civic education and that requires all kinds of things to, right, this isn't a system that's meant to, or that thinks, I mean, it might be meant to, but it doesn't presume it can convince people who have no interest in participating in democratic society, right? You have to, this is a system who kind of want to be, for people who want to be in a free society, in an equal society, and in a fair society, and to, meant to help them think through what that means. Yes?
When you say that your freedom, mm-hmm. as long as it doesn't encroach on other people's
yep.
freedom,
yep.
don't you have to define what freedom is then? I mean, like, if freedom is freedom to be healthy,
mm-hmm.
or is it freedom to go hunting? I mean, you know, mm-hmm. As long as your expression of freedom doesn't encroach on other people's freedom, mm-hmm. We got to define, don't we not, what that freedom is
mm-hmm.
that we're encroaching on? What exactly? I mean, in real terms, in visceral terms.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Rawls might only give us outlines of how to do that. One of the things he's concerned to do with this theory of justice is make it what he calls political, which means that, you know, a lot of, for him, that means that a lot of people could agree to it. Anybody interested in living in a democratic society could hold these principles of justice. But it's not meant to be an overall theory of morality for you. So he wants to ensure that you can have a pluralist society, that people have lots of different concerns, lots of different ideas about what a good life is. And your good life might include hunting, and mine might include something else, right? And he wants to allow for lots of different... This is part of what freedom is. It's being able to kind of develop your own conception of the good. And so, yeah, we'd have to have really hard debates, and I think it's really good to think through those. Like, what are examples in our society where we struggle with this? Of saying, at what point does my pursuing my own conception of the good start to actually prevent other people from pursuing theirs? And I think health is a good example, right? Because health seems to compromise anybody's ability to pursue a good life. Certain levels of extreme poverty or extreme sort of, precarious access to food, like, these things are, I think... a little more tangible because they seem to compromise anybody from pursuing their conception of the good life. But something, you know, some other things are hard, right? At what point is your access to, you know, I don't know, hunting wolves compromising somebody else's conception of the good life? Those are nitty-gritty conceptions. But I think Rawls at least wants to give us language for when can you say enough, right? When can you say, yeah, I want you to have an expansive ability to create your own conception of the good life, but the way you're doing it is actually preventing other people from living theirs. And there are going to be some hard compromises that end up there. I think there are easy cases like health and education, and there are harder cases, especially when it comes to things like land management or something like that.
I'm really intrigued by Rawls's work, and I really appreciate the walk here this morning because I actually don't know very much about it. I'm just intrigued by it, and I think one of the reasons why I'm intrigued by it or drawn to it is the notion that he acknowledges that there are inequalities. Mm-hmm. He doesn't start out with a premise saying, "Hey, we need to eradicate inequality." He said, mm-hmm. "This is just simply a fact of life. There will be inequalities." And then, after sort of acknowledging that, then he comes around and says, it almost puts like a qualifier on there. Mm-hmm. Yes, inequalities are a fact of life, and we ought to structure a system whereby those least off can benefit from whatever inequalities we tolerate and accommodate in our society. Mm-hmm. Is that a correct read?
I think I want to go one step back, and then I think it's correct, right? And that in Rawls's process of justifying this rationally, I think he'll say, yes, inequalities are a fact of life, but they're a fact of life that we could get rid of. So they're not maybe an ineluctable fact of life. But he thinks we know enough about how societies run that we're probably going to tolerate some of them. For, I think, some of the classic reasons that people, you know, do tolerate inequality, right? This is like when one of my students like have studied like 1 week of communism in high school, and they're like, we don't want to be communists because then nobody would do anything, right? There's no motivation, right? I think, I don't know if that's a sophisticated understanding of communism, but there's something right there about human motivation, right? That like people need to see the ability to advance, to be motivated to work, or maybe we'll want inequalities in power because frankly, some people aren't interested in it. And some people really want a lot of power and influence, and some people are happy to kind of do their own thing. So, you know, when we come into the original position, I think one of the reasons to, again, see this as a kind of blind, you know, we're putting ourselves under what Rawls calls this veil of ignorance, right? We're absconding from what we know about our concrete situations. I think one reason to do that is because he thinks at that point, we're going to presume we should be all equal. We should presume there's no inequality. And that we're going to have to argue for the goodness of inequality. And he says, okay, at what situation, if you enter as an equal individual, would you agree to an unequal system? Mm-hmm. And he says it would happen then. I would start to become okay with it if I said it raises everybody's overall mm-hmm. level relative to what an equal system would be. Right? And I think we do this all the time in simple ways, right? That when you divide, you know, either domestic duties or when you kind of enter into a project with other people you work with, like, okay, maybe I'm okay with you, you know, having a greater share in this company, right? Because I think it's actually going to kind of raise the whole level of our success. So yeah, I mean, I guess I would quibble a little bit with like it's a fact of life, but it's certainly, I think, something that Rawls sees we would agree to in most situations because there's often times when we find good justification for allowing some inequality on those grounds.
You know what? I think you hit on something real important there. Some people don't want the authority. It's
right.
About authority. And authority means power, and if you've got the power, that's automatically there's an equal on some level. And some people simply would rather not.
Right.
In fact, probably most people don't really want the grief. So, you know, there's a built-in inequality, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one we live with, and hopefully we would only justify, right? And we start to get nervous when somebody else's power starts giving them so much that it's not kind of helping me out at all.
They got to be good at it.
Right.
And I'm almost thinking about it like a training, like a surgeon. I might want someone who is a trained surgeon operating on me as opposed to somebody who hasn't. And if there's a difference in pay scale where our surgeon is getting X mm-hmm. versus a plumber doing surgery on me, I might want that difference. So I think there's also that connection too, that mm-hmm. I think that naturally happens. Like those are sorts of inequalities in pay that we might not only accept but understand and go like, okay, well, yeah. Maybe there's certain responsibilities or things that go along with a particular job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is always meant to be a kind of ongoing reflection. Like we might get to a point where we say we need to reset this a little bit, right? And I'm no longer comfortable with the disparity between the pay for that job and that job relative to the kind of overall good for society, but certainly we would accept it.
Yeah, and I guess I should say I'd also want Joe the plumber working on my pipes and not the surgeon.
Right.
Just for that other training.
Right.
But, I think there was time.
Yeah.
About the interconnectedness and interdependence of health and education yeah. and economic power and so on. And it seems in this country we've made economics be the linchpin between all of those. And you know, if you have power, you have money. If you have money, you can get health, you can get education, you can have access to shelter, you can have access to opportunity and all these things. So what happens, I mean, how does he resolve that interconnectedness in terms of inequality? I can go get a good education and then I will have a loan that will saddle me.
Right?
So where do those sort of ins and outs in what he's proposing?
Yeah, yeah. It's a good question. And in some ways, right, and I hate to be like pedantic with this, right, but in some ways I think it's like that's the work we have to do, right? We have this kind of model from him, and in any application, I do think this is in some ways meant to help our thinking more than it answers all our problems straight away, right? And so when we're looking at inequalities in society, certainly part of what we would have to do is study those intersections and try to really look at empirical data and see is one causing the other? Are they kind of co-equal phenomena? Or, you know, if we have limited resources, what are we going to spend on, right? Do you spend on education? Does that improve health? If you spend on health, does that help improve people's education? Like where are we going to use these limited resources? I think all of that, Rawls would say, is part of the empirical extension of his principles, right? We have the goal.
Well, it makes me wonder if there might not be a third principle that could guide those conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that
you know, in terms of, like, for example, I think of some, say, more socialist type, you know, thinking in countries, say, in Europe, where they're like, no, you know, education ought to be free. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have these sort of, if you go back to his first principle of equal rights to health and education and those sorts of things, then maybe those are that you have to come back to those, and therefore they shall not be tied to your rights to other things, or some, you know, or your dependence on other things. It seems like another principle could help guide that.
Yeah, it might, and I think that's a really good insight. I will say that the one thing that happens with Rawls's first principle, between like when he first publishes it and some of his later works, is you know when he talks about expansive basic liberties, as long as they're compatible with other liberties, compatible with liberties for all. He does end up adding a clause there about conditions of fair opportunity, because I think one of the things he learns, and I think quite frankly learns from like racial justice movements and gender justice movements, is that equal schemes of basic liberties don't always end up with actual equal access in terms of opportunity, be that educational opportunity or economic opportunity or something like this. So you might be right that the third principle is needed. I think there are ways he's trying to work it into kind of that first principle of, okay, what do we really need for fair opportunity to kind of exercise these freedoms? But I kind of like the idea of a third principle. It's kind of fun to think through.
And I think there was one more, and then we'll go to our
Cool.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up, actually, my animal welfare class came up. There's these things called five freedoms that we talk about, and it's like taking care of other animals in terms of they should have freedom to drink water, freedom to access to food, freedom of shelter, freedom from disease, like these basic needs that animals need met in order to live a successful or even have a decent quality of life. Like if we aren't healthy, you know, we can't really get that quality of life to have opportunities. So people in poverty don't have access to water sometimes, don't have access to food, they don't have money to buy these things for themselves. So I think that's where that balancing act is, like, yeah, there's people who have yachts, like, in the Caribbean, and then there's somebody who literally, like, can't even buy a meal for their children. So that's where it's, like, the skills I see, like, basic needs are being met for our impoverished people. So, yeah, that's where my mind is.
Are we about to walk?
Yeah, I think so.
At the next stop, I'm going to try, the next couple stops, I'm going to hopefully talk less and let you guys talk more, and think about how we might apply some of this thinking or revise some of it in relation to specific issues. So I'm going to draw one from Rawls himself, but I think I'm going to draw the first just from our environs today. So I'm interested thinking at the next stop about what a kind of Rawlsian system, or even just another kind of system of fairness and justice, would look like in relation to kind of environmental goods, right, and environmental justice, and maybe think through what that might look like locally. Some of our comments are already kind of pushing in that direction, because I think they're interesting. Rawls does not write very much on this himself, but there have been some interesting extensions of his theory by other thinkers. So what is just environmental? Or what's environmental justice look like, and what principles might we want there? And I think that'll be something to think about on our wanderings.